Good afternoon. I'm Professor Larry Jacobs. I'm a faculty at the University of Minnesota, Department of Political Science, and the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and I also direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Humphrey School, which is bringing you today's program. And I just want to set the scene. We're going to jump off right into this terrific conversation today. I want to give you a heads up. We've got some programs coming up. We do a lot of programs on healthcare and health reform. We've got one coming up July 23rd at noon Central. It's looking at the possibility of some real innovations in medical care delivery and healthcare as a result of COVID-19. We've got some terrific people for that. One of the things that the center has done is create one of the first professional training programs in election administration. If you're someone who would like to start a new career, there's a generational turnover, you might want to look at this. If you're someone in election administration, this is a great way to upskill. And we've got a lot of programs, courses coming up in the fall. And July 27th, we're going to have an informational session that will include alumni of this program. It's one of the first online programs, brings together the top talent in the country as instructors. And that's July 27th. We've got a program coming up on July 29th on the rise and kind of decline of conservatism as a populist enduring movement. Peter Wehner, who worked in the Reagan administration as a prominent conservative, will be on that panel with David Hopkins, who is a political scientist at Boston College. And then coming up August 13th, we've got a program on election security. Yes, there are foreign powers trying to tamper with our elections. We've got some terrific people going to be joining that panel. And I want to let you know that in today's conversation, which we're now going to be moving towards, we welcome your participation. You'll see at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button. Please give us questions. We're going to get to as many as possible. I'm delighted now to introduce the moderator of today's conversation, my very talented friend and colleague in the Department of Political Science, Dr. Michael Minta.
Thank you, Professor Jacobs. Thanks, Larry. It's great. Great introduction. We're very excited. We have a very distinguished panel here today to really talk about Black Lives Matter and how it'll impact the upcoming elections. We'll spend most of our time mostly talking about the presidential elections, but we can also talk about some down ticket races like congressional races, state, and even maybe some local elections. So we're pleased to have this distinguished panelist of my colleagues join us, many who are award-winning authors and scholars in our field of political science. So our first panelist will be Professor Christopher Parker, who's a professor in political science at the University of Washington, Seattle. He's written several books relating to topics such as Black veterans and their role in the civil rights movement and the rise of the Tea Party. He's working on a new title, The Great White Hope, Donald Trump, Race and the Crisis of American Democracy. So welcome, Professor Parker. We also have Professor LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, who is an assistant professor in political science at Princeton University. Her research interests include racial attitudes, Black politics, and public opinion. She has a new book that's out, and I can't wait to purchase it. It's called Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. And I think, LaFleur, that book will be available at the end of this month, right?
Yes. Yes. And for a pre-order on Amazon.
That's right. So order it. And then we have a last Professor Ashley Jardina. She is an assistant professor in political science at Duke University. Her work focuses on racial attitudes and racial conflict and group identities and voting behaviors in the U.S. And she also has a book that's now out called White Identity Politics that's available in most bookstore, so make sure you go out and pick up your copy. You know, under normal times and It's hard to say that we're in normal times right now. In this panel, we would have our panelists out to Minnesota and talk about our 10,000 lakes and talk about Prince. But right now, we're not in normal times. So, and part of this panel is motivated by the Black Lives Matter and many of the events that happened here in the Twin Cities with the George Floyd killing and the social protests surrounding it. And so we're here to try to see how this makes sense and will it have an impact on the upcoming 2020 elections. So I have a few questions for our panelists. And so I wanted to start with Professor Giardina. I have a question. So what we're noticing right now is that there are many, that Kelly Loeffler, who's running in Georgia right now for the US Senate, she has recently said about Black Lives Matter, because there are many proposals such as sweeping changes with defunding the police, looking at systemic racism. But Senator Kelly Loeffler, who's running, has actually come out against Black Lives Matter. I quote, she says, this is a very divisive organization, Black Lives Matter. This is very divisive in terms of it has Marxist principles. This week, they threatened to burn the system down literally and figuratively, and if they don't get what they want. And of course, the president, Donald Trump, has also said that Black Lives Matter is a hate organization. So I'm just wondering, people who come out opposing Black Lives Matter, are they racist? Or is there something else that's going on here?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Michael. I mean, I think that a lot of people in the United States and many white Americans hold views that are pretty racially prejudiced and racially conservative. And one of the strongest predictors of whether or not you support or oppose Black Lives Matter in the movement is where you fall on a lot of these measures we have of racism. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that in the midst of all of this and really impressive optimism, we're seeing a lot of white Americans turning out to support the Black Lives Matter movement. We're seeing a lot of white people show up to the protests. There's still an enormous partisan divide in support for the movement and support for a lot of the policies that the movement is putting forward. And so we can't discount the fact that many white Republicans many white Republicans do hold views that are more racially prejudiced than many white Democrats are not supportive of these policies. And so it's strategic for a lot of white politicians running for office to run against the Black Lives Matter movement because a lot of their white constituents don't support the movement or a lot of its policy proposals.
Okay, thank you. Professor Stevens Dugan, I wanted to kind of follow up on that question. So, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the recent political ad by President Trump showing pictures. I don't know if it's here in Minneapolis, but where the protests, where people, kind of the negative things in terms of vandalizing businesses, setting fires on businesses. I like the end of the commercial where it says, "This is Joe Biden's America. Do you want to live in that?" And so I wanted to know, is it those type of attacks and those type of political ads, do they have an effect? Because there are several authors who've written that Joe Biden, even David Axelrod, who was just on one of the panels last week, said these race-based campaign ads just won't work because he's an old working class, middle class, white man. So these type of attacks will have no impact. Can you provide some insight on what the research or literature might say about this?
Sure, thanks for that. I'd have to say that the notion that those types of ads couldn't really affect a Joe Biden because he's an older white man, I think that's a little optimistic, maybe overly sanguine, in the sense that, no, he's not Kamala Harris, he's not Hillary Clinton, and of course is maybe not susceptible to some of the gendered ways in which Donald Trump might have been able to attack him. He's also, of course, older and he is white, but that does not mean that he's immune from some of the attacks that research has shown Republican candidates have often leveled against Democrats, even white Democrats. That is to say that for anyone who's affiliated with the Democratic Party, an easy sort of wedge issue are things like crime and race and the stereotype that Democrats are going to be too beholden to their African-American constituents or their constituents of color more broadly. So while Biden might not be as susceptible as other Democrats who, you know, women or people of color, it certainly by no means means that he's immune.
Okay, that's excellent. And I'll have a follow-up question later about that. Professor Parker, I have a question. So you've written extensively about white reactionary movements in the United States. And of course, after the election of President Barack Obama, we saw the rise of the Tea Party. And I'm just wondering, there's no black candidate on the ballot, or at least not yet, for president. And I'm wondering, is there any type of movement brewing right now? Let's say if there's a world where there is a president, Joe Biden, do we see anything on the horizon with that?
Well, thank you for asking the question. Well, first of all, I mean, back then, you know, what Matt and I argued in the book is that, you know, it was about Obama and everything he represents that occasioned the rise of the Tea Party. And so basically, whenever there's some perceived black progress, there is going to be some white reaction. I mean, we've seen that historically. I mean, we can always go all the way back to Reconstruction. I mean, this happens all the time. The periodicity varies, but it happens all the time. And we're seeing it again right now. So basically what I'm suggesting here is if we don't get Obama, we don't get Trump. If Obama's not president, Trump does not get elected, right? So let's get that off the table right now. But I don't see any, we're already seeing a reaction right now with the Black Lives Matter, right? So the reaction is already here, right? Think about what's going on with COVID-19. So I think, I'm sure all of us on this panel knew that as soon as COVID hit, we were gonna discover race-based disparities. I know Larry knows this, you know, he's part of the Robert Wood Johnson family, as am I. And so we knew we were gonna see race-based health disparities. What's crazy, but also deeply disturbing is that as soon as these race-based health disparities were disseminated, at least the knowledge of them were disseminated, you know, then we start seeing Trump trying to pull back and wanting to open everything up. And then we start seeing these anti-lockdown protesters all over the place. So I think there's a reaction already here, right? And it's just going to continue apace, you know, with the movement, with the continued freedom struggle. We saw the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. This is just another phase of the freedom struggle, if you ask me. So as long as we see an active phase of the freedom struggle, we're going to see some white reaction.
Okay, I wanted to follow up on that. And by the way, I noticed that that jersey you're wearing. Trying to make a statement here. Yes. So I had a question again about speaking of symbols, right? And obviously, Black Lives Matter. Colin Kaepernick became a symbol of the Black Lives Matter movement. And actually, this question could be for all the panelists to jump in. We see this move to kind of like move to get rid of Confederate flags, monuments across the country. And many people are saying this is kind of a solution to getting rid of some of the systemic racism that's going on. So do you think by moving many of these symbols, like NASCAR moved their symbol, and I think even the team in Washington, the professional football team, is talking about removing their nickname. I mean, how does this play into the political picture? Could you provide some insight? Because president's been using this type of symbolism for a while. Is it effective in addressing systemic racism? And also, how could it be used in a political context? So, Professor Parker, and then we can go to the rest of the panel.
Okay, sure. I think it's going to make the political environment even worse because it's, you know, the Confederate flag. I mean, I don't know if anyone's has seen this. I'm sure you guys have seen this piece in the New York Times. I forgot the woman's name, but she says, you know, my body is a Confederate monument. When she's talking about she has rape-colored skin, right? That, and the whole point is, like, how can these people celebrate, you know, the South, right, or the lost cause, given that, you know, all this rape and oppression was going on, right? That's, to many of us who are Black, I would venture to say to all of us that are Black, that's what that flag represents. And so even though you have some of these, you know, some of white people, you know, who celebrate the Confederate flag, and this, the late sociologist John Shelton Reed and Howard Odom wrote extensively on this, that there is this Southern identity, part of which is consistent with or commensurate with, you know, the celebration of this lost cause. Now, I don't know if these people just don't know history, or they just want to ignore it, or if it's motivated reasoning, if you will. But the problem is that if you take this away from them, right, they feel like that's part of their identity, right? Now, I'm just confining this to the South for right now. And so that's going to cause some backlash, right? And then if you go beyond the South, right, and we think about, we see all these Confederate battle flags, you know, I refuse to call him President Trump, at 45 rallies, right? That's not about Southern heritage. That's about something else. That's about racial oppression. So when you start removing those symbols, A, and then B, these nicknames, right, like the team from Washington, the Redskins, and now you have other teams that are reviewing this, right, the Cleveland Indians, right, you know, the Atlanta Braves. And so for a lot of these people, they have, and I have friends who are fans of these teams, and white friends, if you will, and I don't really perceive them to be racist, but they cling to these nicknames, right? And these are educated people, some of whom are our colleagues, right, who love the quote-unquote Redskins and love the Braves and love the Indians, right? So I wouldn't say it'd be a racial backlash per se from them, right? I think that's more of this attachment to these symbols or these teams with whom they grew up. But for a lot of these people, yes, you know, you're ripping away, you know, these symbols with whom or with which they identify, right? And most of it is about oppression of people of color.
Professor Giardina, could you follow up on that? Professor Parker was saying this idea, because most people tend to think when people are against Black Lives Matter or whether or not they're supporting a Confederate flag, that this is, there's some type of racial animus in it. And so I know that you're saying that there might be something else that's involved behind these Confederate symbols.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I want to do first is just echo Chris's important point about the relationship between sort of Southern pride and Southern history and support for the flag. You know, there's some evidence that the less you know about Southern history, the more likely you are to support Confederate symbols. And so it's clear that they're often more about things with respect to race. But, you know, one of the things that I think a lot about in my own work is the fact that we often think about racism and racial prejudice as just sort of this set of stereotypes that your grandmother or your mother taught you that mean that you don't like people of color, or you think that they don't work hard enough, or you know, a host of other negative attributes. And I think that what we have to keep in mind is that for a lot of white Americans, and a lot of white Americans who are flying their Confederate flags right next to their Trump flags in parts of the United States, that what they're also worried about is the loss of power and status that racial equality means for white people in the United States. And so that's what I mean when I think that there's more than just racial animus here, there's also this feeling of threat, and that many white Americans feel like the election of Obama, the changing demographics of the nation, that this represents something more than just the sort of hostility or animus that they might have. The other thing I wanted to say too is that, you know, symbols do matter. Most of the Confederate symbols in the United States were put in place well after the Civil War as a means of sort of intimidating Black Americans and trying to reassert sort of white power in South and across the country. And so the fact that they're being removed is not inconsequential, but I think the thing that we need to talk about is, to what extent are these really going to help us achieve racial equality, is taking down these symbols, right? We need to have real serious conversations instead about how do we close the wealth gap between Black and White Americans? How do we reform policing in the United States? How do we deal with unequal housing and unequal schools? That's the important conversation. And that's not the conversation that I'm seeing the news pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, a very interesting point because, you know, most of us would think that when you white solidarity, you know, people like, there's no way when you think of white solidarity, it's KKK, surely it's racist, right? But when we say that to racial and ethnic minority groups, it's like, oh, that's fine, right? Because they've been marginalized groups. And so they built it based on a history of discrimination. But the argument that you're making, which is quite subtle, that whites are actually becoming a minority in many states, right? In California, in Texas, and by 2050, whites will not be the majority in the population. And so you're seeing a lot of what's being tapped in by the Trump administration is this appeal where whites are now starting to feel an identity, like I am white. So that's a very interesting and subtle point. We can get back to it. Professor Stevens Dugan, I had a follow-up question about the attacks on Biden. So you're saying he's not immune to it. So does that make his VP choice even more important, like based on what you've said? Because, I mean, Biden said he's going to pick a woman. I mean, and he said he's going to appoint a Black woman to the Supreme Court. I mean, these are things that Barack Obama would never say. It probably couldn't get away with either, right? So Is Biden being a little cavalier about this based on what you said earlier about he could be impacted by this?
Well, I mean, I think you raise a lot of good points. One, Biden is not constrained in the way that Obama was, right? Just by virtue of being that older white male Democrat, he doesn't necessarily have to run away from race to the degree that we saw with Obama. His association with people of color, I mean, I think it will rile up some on the right, those racially conservative whites, they won't be excited about probably a woman VP pick, even if she is, say, a white woman, and certainly not a Black woman. But I think this is also part of a larger question of what strategy the Democratic Party is hoping to pursue. So there's often this sort of obsession with, you know, the working class whites or non-college educated whites or, you know, whatever we're calling them these days, maybe also to some degree also soccer moms and suburban moms and things of that nature. And so one sort of strategy that they've historically pursued is this kind of obsession with those groups, right? So like, what pick does he make? If he picks a Black woman, is it going to isolate those people? Are they going to run to, you know, the Republican Party, or are they just going to stay home? And there is, you know, that sort of precarity that's involved with the choice that he might make. But on the other hand, there's another option and another strategy that the Democratic Party could pursue, but has not necessarily historically done so. And that's an option of really choosing a VP candidate, most likely, I think, a woman of color, who could really mobilize and energize their base of people of color. And that's a part of the discussion that I don't think that we hear as much about. And so, yeah, we can worry about the isolation or how that might turn off some voters, but there's also the flip side of that where you can really energize and mobilize a base, particularly for Black women who we know have historically been some of the most loyal supporters of the Democratic Party. And so that's a strategy that could also be pursued. But I think this sort of obsession with working class whites tends to cloud our view on the benefits that could be associated with that. And one other thing that I'd like to say about that point, you know, that there is, there is Black people in states like Michigan, right? There's Black people in Detroit, there's Black people in Philly, there's Black people, you know, in Milwaukee, places that, you know, Trump won, or states that Trump won that are likely to be battlegrounds this year. And if you can mobilize people of color on the left, potentially through a VP pick, but not only through that symbol, there might not have to be so much concern about what that's going to do to isolate some working class whites on the other side.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point, because I was going to actually anticipate a later question of, we're so concerned about the appeals to whites in many of these battleground states, but with the growing number of racial and ethnic minorities as they get incorporated into the to the electorate, that Democrats are thinking that, hey, maybe we can still win without necessarily, that we could withstand a Trump type of election of racial appeals. But I'm curious, and I can ask all the panelists too, I wanna put you on the spot. Black Lives Matter has really, it's been prominent since, you know, the Michael Brown shooting, but also, I mean, recently with the George Floyd killing. And so I'm just thinking, like, Amy Klobuchar, our own senator here in Minnesota, chances of being VP, gone after George Floyd. Kamala Harris, I mean, she's been brought up, but her history as a prosecutor has made her very, people in the Black Lives Matter really kind of suspicious of her. And then Val Demings, the other Black woman who's being considered as a, you know, police chief. And so I'm just wondering, like, what type of impact, I mean, will Biden take that into consideration? Will they get kept off of the ticket because of this, because Black Lives Matter activists may not want a candidate with that type of background? In the past, those backgrounds were valued, but now in this environment, maybe less so.
Is that question for me specifically, or?
Oh yes, you could take it.
You know, it's hard to say, because it's hard to say where is Biden, honestly. So I don't have a firm opinion on that in terms of what he's likely to do. I do think that criminal justice background is likely to hurt those potential choices. But I don't necessarily think that will keep them off of the ticket, because there's a certain level of symbolism and they might have a bit more latitude than, say, an Amy Klobuchar in that same sort of position. So I don't think that necessarily completely excludes them from a potential choice for him.
So can I speak to this? So I think
yes, press part.
Floor is right. Let me just put a slightly different spin on it. I think so for whatever, I mean, so one thing we have to be clear about, whether or not Black Lives Matter, whether or not people that support the movement are actually going to go to the polls, right? I mean, we have to establish that first. And I'm not sure how well that's been established. A, B, for whatever support that they might lose, that Biden might lose and Democrats might lose from Black Lives Matter activists from picking Val Demings or Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, that's not even a consideration, right? He needs to have a Black woman. It'll be offset by the comfort that a law enforcement background would give to independence, right? So I think that whatever support the Democrats would lose from Black Lives Matter activists, I think they would more than make up for when it comes to independence and having them mobilize and vote for Democrats this time.
Professor Jardina, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I don't have a good hunch about who the likely pick is going to be, but I imagine that the Biden campaign is sitting there thinking about whether there's going to be sufficient turnout from people who are so angry at Trump, or whether they need to really find someone who's going to help mobilize liberal white Democrats and people of color, because as Dr. Parker said, turnout's one of the most important questions moving into 2020, and you know, add the coronavirus on top of everything, compounding concerns about turnout. You know, it's not just what does public opinion look like right now, but it's to what extent are people who are supportive of the Democratic Party and supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, are they going to show up and vote? And we don't know what the answer to that question is right now.
Professor Stevens, Jardina, and this is for all the panelists, but I'll start with you. Is this just a moment, or are we seeing a changing landscape? I mean, we're seeing that public opinion polls support for Black Lives Matter in 2015. I mean, you couldn't find a majority other than Blacks supporting this movement. I mean, is this a change in the way that politics is going to be handled at the federal level and the national level, or is this just a brief moment in time with George Floyd, the coronavirus, and then once everything passes, we'll go back to normal politics?
Well, I think if history is any teacher, then I am probably not that optimistic. I think this is more likely to be a political moment versus real systemic change. And I think this goes back to the points made earlier by Professor Parker and Professor Giardino, which is essentially that a lot of what we're seeing is symbolism, right? So it's easy to say, you know, we're taking away Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben or things like that, or even, you know, Confederate symbols that do matter. I don't want to discount that these symbols don't have meaning. But when it comes to real systemic change, just as a student of history and of politics, my sense is that there are going to be, you know, it's likely that very few white Americans are really going to want to kind of risk their own privilege and status in the racial hierarchy to make the true systematic change that is needed. But, you know, I'd love to be proven wrong on that.
Can I speak on this, please?
Professor Parker, yes.
So I think, so for Professor Stevens Dugan, I see exactly where you're coming from. I'm a black man in America, you know, I got to be skeptical about stuff. Having said that, I mean, I'm of two minds on this. I mean, that's a $64,000 question, whether or not this is a movement or a moment. And I go back and forth on that with some frequency. You know, on the one hand, you know, we've seen this happen several times. And I said this in an interview recently. It's like every time something like this happens, you know, black people are Charlie Brown and white people's Lucy, right? Always snatching the ball away at the last second. And is this another one of those moments? So what gives me some hope is that, you know, there was a recent survey done of protesters in New York City, 61% of whom were white and roughly 20% were black, right? So that gives me some hope. And we see just how diverse these protests are, right? I mean, that's really heartening from that perspective. The problem, if you will, is that there are all of these, there's this confluence of events. I mean, you've mentioned them, Professor Menta, that are all happening simultaneously, right? We have COVID-19, the racial health disparities, right? We see the murder of George Floyd there in Minneapolis, right? And then you have a racist president, right? Well, we've always had racist presidents from time to time. Most of us, you know, who know anything about healthcare and about race know that there are the disparities. They've always been around. They just come more and more to the fore. And this would not be the first time that police brutality has sparked, you know, some uprising. We saw it in the 1960s. So one can make a case, you know, either way. I have to say, ultimately, I'm on the side of Professor Dugan Stevens. It's like, you gotta show me, because right now I'm not a huge believer. Because what happens when COVID goes away, you know, and Biff, you know, and Tiffany, they're like, oh shoot, okay, all right, we don't have time to protest anymore. We gotta go shopping or we gotta go surfing, right? So I'm a little concerned about that. Right now, there's a captive audience. What happens when things return to some semblance of normalcy? That's what concerns me.
And can I, so I want to go to a question from our audience, and it's a nice follow-up to what you were just saying, Professor Parker. And one audience member wants to know, is there a structure to Black Lives Matter? Is there anyone who is a national leader in a movement similar to Dr. Martin Luther King in the 1950s and the 1960s?
Well, I'll say, I mean, they were founded by, or the movement was founded by, three queer women of color. So to that extent, I guess you could call them leaders, but I think the movement prides itself on being what they would call leaderful, not leaderless, in the sense that you can't necessarily speak to, point to sort of one national spokesperson, but they kind of, I can't speak for the movement, but I think they sort of envision themselves as having leaders all about, you know, it's more decentralized, but that the idea that you're going to have this sort of one iconic leader who speaks for the group and makes the group platform, I don't think that's kind of how they envision their movement. And, you know, there's pros and cons that comes with that type of structural organization.
Anyone else want to shout at it? Okay. Yeah, and that's one challenge that you'll have with these type of organizations, that there isn't, it's not necessarily NAACP, the Urban League, where you have people lobbying Congress. You're seeing changes at, you know, at the state and local levels, but not necessarily the big push at the federal level. So that's a great question and a good answer. Here's another question, again, related to Black Lives Matter. Will we see more politicians making a distinction between supporting the notion that Black Lives Matter and being able to say, while not supporting the organization or their platform? So essentially, they can say they support it, but not do anything substantive. Professor Giardina?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is pretty consistent with what we're observing when we just think about white Democrats' attitudes about the movement and a lot of the policies that the movement supports. You know, one of the things that I've noted is if you look at public opinion polls, a lot of white liberals are becoming much more supportive of both the movement, of reducing racial inequality in the abstract, you know, of things that, of taking non-Confederate symbols. But when you actually ask whites on both sides of the partisan aisle, you know, do you support reparations? Do you support actual policies that would help really create greater racial equality in the United States? Most white Americans aren't really on board, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And so, you know, I think that it's an easy gesture for politicians to say they support the goals of the movement. It's going to garner a lot of support from white Democrats when they do so. But the fact of the matter is that the moment Democrats start talking about reparations, they probably are going to lose some support from some white Democrats.
So can I just piggyback on what
Professor
Giardina said? So that's what Professor Giardina is referring to, is what's typically known in the discipline as a principle policy gap, right? So you have widespread support for these principles, but when it actually comes down to the rubber hitting the road, right, when it comes to implementation of some kind of substantive policy, that's where you lose all support. Same thing happened in, you know, these Michigan people, I know who this is, Schumann and Bobo and Steve's book, Racial Attitudes in America, where they show how the principal policy gap, you know, remained pretty wide in the South in the 50s and even all the way through the 60s, right? I mean, so you had white Southerners that were more for equal rights, you know, in an abstract sense, but when it actually came down to integrating their kids in the same school as Black kids, they wanted no parts of that.
Yeah, exactly. Just to, you know, add to that a really important point, when you look at surveys asking white Americans, how do you feel about a wealth tax? How do you feel about reparations? How do you feel about busing your kids to reduce segregation? How do you feel about building affordable housing in your neighborhood to increase the diversity of your neighborhood? White Democrats, the same ones who say that they're supportive of racial equality, aren't very supportive of those policies.
Now, do we see, following up on that question, do you see any differences by generation? Are younger people more supportive of these substantive policies, or is it mostly older people who are opposed to them? Do we see any differences there?
Yeah, the younger people are more progressive in their attitudes towards these policies. Absolutely. There are definitely generational differences, but they're not as large as you might expect them to be either.
So, and often, can I just add one point on that? Often the research suggests that, you know, say, for example, white millennials are actually closer to their parents and their racial attitudes than they are to their millennial peers of color. So that is to say that even if they are more progressive than older white Americans, they're not as progressive as other people of their generation who are people of color. And so that suggests that even, you know, as we get maybe quote unquote generational replacement, there's still likely to be a gap between the interests and the policy preferences of people of color and their white counterparts.
So can I just add to what Professor Duke and Stevens said? This whole cohort replacement thing was written about as far back as the 1980s, right? And it was really in this famous piece by the sociologist Fireball and Davis, in which they, you know, said that this should
Professor Parker, could you explain cohort replacement?
I was getting ready to get to that. So it's this idea that when older, more quote unquote racist or conservative, if you will, white cohorts die off, they would be replaced by more progressive white cohorts. And that was almost 40 years ago, and we're still having the same problems, right? So this whole sort of cohort replacement thing isn't working. And just to what Professor Dugan Stevens said, it's like, we're not seeing, you know, these kids that are departing too far from what their parents are. They're closer to their parents than they are to their millennial peers. And so the political socialization literature is shot through with these kind of results where you have this socialization that goes from parent to child.
Well, it's good point. I want to go to another question by an audience member. Let's see. Okay, this is a little different. And this relates to the actual, let me see this, let me scroll through. I lost the question. So the question was about turnout. And do you think that even though Black Lives Matter and this idea of mobilizing people who aren't normally participating in politics, that yes, they may have all this energy, but there might be these different efforts to try to stop people from actually getting to the polls. We've seen news reports now of possibly closing some precincts in some of these battleground states. And we've also heard of, and the president is actually, President Trump has actually come out and said that he's kind of against the mail-in balloting. So the audience member is concerned about what type of impact could this have on the election. So we can start with Professor Stevens Dugan. Take a shot at it.
I'd like to note one point, and this is also a plug for the research of a colleague of ours, Davin Phoenix. I think one of the things that people sort of assume is that because people on the left, namely people of color, are angry, that this is actually going to translate to people showing up at the polls. And his research would actually argue that for Black Americans and to some extent other people of color, anger does not mobilize in the way that we've historically seen with their white counterparts. And that also speaks to, I think, you know, Professor Parker's book on the Tea Party and reactionary politics. So anger tends to be a mobilizing force for white Americans, but it doesn't necessarily translate into traditional means of participation for Black people, right? So they might get angry and they might go protest, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're gonna show up at the polls in November. So taking, trying to clarify that, I don't think Democrats should rest on the notion that, like, oh, because people are angry and they're in the streets and they're protesting, that this means that they're necessarily going to turn out in large numbers for Biden in the fall. So there has to be a mobilization game on the ground, and anger and just being anti-Trump research suggests that that's not enough. Now, in terms of some of the institutional factors that are preventing people from showing up to the polls, we should be worried. And I'd like to hear more of a plan about how there's going to be an opportunity to mobilize these people, especially given COVID, right? So you have people, we're expecting to see mass evictions where people will be much more, not tied to a stable address and things of those natures, attacks on mail-in voting, absentee voting, closing of polling places. These are all things that I, trying to keep my academic hat on and not my partisan hat, but I would hope that Democrats are thinking about a ground game to get people mobilized and to keep people enthused, because we're likely to see long polling lines. We're likely to see people potentially literally putting their lives at risk to go to the polls in the midst of a pandemic. So I think the person who posed that question has a right to be concerned.
Can I speak to this for a second? So let me just push back on that a little bit. And I'll say this, that some of the research, some experimental research that I've done recently. So I would say that, and I've read Professor Phoenix's book, but what I would say is that none of the research that he's done or other people have done have been based on Trump. And Trump is a singular threat. So some of the, like I do some consulting work on the side, so I am able to put these little experiments and stuff together. And it's unbelievable how mobilized Black folks are, how committed they are to turning out or in their enthusiasm when we start asking questions about Trump and about his handling of COVID. Black people are pissed off right now, right? And so I would not underestimate that. Second, I've also done some other work showing that the extent to which Black people see Trump as a threat, even after accounting for a host and a variety of other controls, that they're still committed to turning out, right? Over and above all the other more conventional predictors. So I would push back on Professor Phoenix's thesis, at least as it pertains to Trump, given the work that I've done recently. And that now the threat, I'm thinking the threat might have to do something with anger, right? And then motivating them to get out. I don't know for sure because we didn't ask questions about anger qua anger. It was really just about Trump. So it could be something else pushing them out there. It could be a sense of injustice, right? But I'm just saying that I think in this moment, anti-Trump is enough to mobilize people of color.
Can I ask a question to that? So do you think that there's some sort of political learning that took place between 2016 and 2020? Because
let me expand on that just for a second, right? So before, I don't think a lot of Black folks thought that this guy was actually going to win, right? So now this guy gets into office and he's doing all of these shady things and he's saying all of these shady things and they see how anti-Black he is now. I mean, for sure. Before, it might have been speculation. Now it's a fact.
Okay, I guess. I think maybe we're all learning that his presidency is worse than we might have anticipated. But I guess we had the information. The writing was on the wall in 2016.
It was.
Well, Professor Park, I was going to say, I'm sure it's more than Black people that were surprised that Donald Trump was going to win the presidency. I mean, he came very close to winning the state of Minnesota too.
I was one of the people that predicted he was going to win. So this is one Black person who was a surprise.
Yeah. so the strategy. So anyway, let me get to the questions up here because I have other questions, but let's see one about, that's just so many good ones. So one respondent, audience member wants to know about Black Lives Matter and about racism with Blacks. Will it start to include other minorities as well? Do you think that it will become from, and not necessarily the All Lives Matter retort that we hear, but will it start including other racial and ethnic groups in their coalition? Or maybe they already have. Anyone want? Take a shot at that question. Okay. Well, I will provide a brief reply. My understanding of the Black Lives Matter movement, again, it's broadly construed that it does include other groups or under marginalized groups, and particularly not just on race, but on sexual orientation. So it's a much broader movement, but obviously with the George Floyd, it's focused mostly on Blacks and their treatment with the police. So it would be interesting to see if they will make this a much broader group beyond Blacks. But right now it's mostly Blacks and the diversity within the Black community.
I do have one thing I want to add that I've been thinking about with respect to that, you know, which is that after Trump won, you know, when we think about what's transpired in the years during his administration, we've seen women turn out to protest over concern about women's rights. We've seen Black Americans turn out to protest in response to George Floyd and all of the inequalities in the United States. But one thing to think about is Trump's campaign was enormously successful because he ran almost initially and then almost entirely on an anti-immigration campaign. And that's always been his go-to prior to the pandemic for how to sort of rally his base. And we haven't really seen reactionary, responsive, the sort of pro-immigration or in support of immigrants or in support of the Latino community. And I think that's kind of interesting. That's kind of the missing constituency here that's pushing back against Trump. And one thing I'm wondering about is, you know, given the opportunity moving into the election season, is Trump going to try to kind of return to those old tactics, and will they be effective?
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I'm. Yeah, that is a very interesting question, and I wish we knew that answer. I mean, obviously, Professor Stevens Dugan and Professor Parker are fairly skeptical about this, but we shall see, right?
Okay,
let's just get a vaccine. Let's get a vaccine first, and then we'll really.
Let me just add one other thing. So there's like a tiny rift in. I haven't got all the way to Latinx yet, in the Latino community, when it comes to support for Black Lives Matter, because you do have some who recognize that, you know, this is not only happening to Black folks, but it's also happening to brown folks as well. But then again, you have this, you have another portion of the Latino community who are, you know, they're anti-Black, right? And so you clearly you're not getting participation from them. And so, you know, so you have this divide right now in the Latino community. There are some who are really down with Black Lives Matter and others who are like, that's not for us. That's not happening to us. That's that applies to those folks over there.
Mm-hmm. And you're particularly seeing it in these states where Latinos, where it's, they're the largest minority group in, you know, California. We know Texas is changing. And so we might see those we've seen those battles played out like in at the cities, like with Los Angeles. But it'll be interesting to see how that happens at a statewide once Latinos start to grow. Will there be a coalition or will there be more conflict? And we know there's extensive research on that particular topic. I'm going to give you this question just to lighten it a little bit. It's not related to Black Lives Matter, but it says, with so many liberal professors, of course we're not liberal, are we? Teachers and students in today's schools that are recently graduated, is there a massive wave of liberalism coming? Is the Republican Party doomed? And we kind of heard these type of arguments, particularly when Obama won in 2008, that this is the country's changing, demographics are telling the story. Now, obviously, that was interrupted with the election of Donald Trump for reasons pointed out by Professor Parker in his Tea Party book. But is Trump just a momentary bump in the road for where this country is headed?
Like, bump in the road?
What's that?
Did you really say bump in the road?
Look, well, I mean,
let me explain this to you.
Hey, the most you can get is two terms.
Bump in the road. Look, let me tell you something. Man. These people have always been here, right? They ain't going any place. They always been here. They're gonna be here, right? I'm just saying that Trump actually bought them out, and like I've argued other places. I know this is going to be controversial. You guys are going to look askance at me or give me the side eye, but I'm telling you right now, this dude is one of the best things that's happening in this country. Let me unpack that for a second.
Okay.
People can no longer deny that this is a fundamentally racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic country, period. Before that, you know, there was some plausible deniability. Oh, are you sure that was sexism? Oh, are you sure that was racism? Really? Right? Well, people are tired of getting gaslit. And so now this guy is sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. What are you going to say? It's right there, right? And all these people still support him. He still's got, what, like 85% support from 87%, maybe even 90% support from Republicans? Come on. These people have always been here. It's not like they just came out of nowhere and they're going to remain here. So to answer your question, hell no, he's not a bump in the road.
And to add to that, I would say that he's kind of opened the playbook for other politicians in the sense that, you know, maybe there was some sort of sense that, you know, you couldn't say that or you couldn't do that or you couldn't be so overtly racist. But I think he's taught others, you know, you gave the example of Kelly Loeffler in Georgia. They know that, like, to some degree, they can do this without consequence from their base.
Yeah, and it turns out that liberal college professors are not that effective at indoctrinating the young minds of the American public. But, you know, even so, it's not really clear that liberalism is sweeping the United States. I mean, Trump did win in 2016, like, you know, to echo Dr. Barker and Dr. Stevens' point, right? You know, and plenty of Republicans, the majority of Republicans support Trump. The majority of Republicans, when they turn out to vote in 2020, they're going to vote for Donald Trump.
So let me just add to what was just said real quick. So people wonder why, you know, Trump retained so much support from Republicans. And it goes back to what Professor Jardine had said a little earlier. Look, this is not about material self-interest, right? This is not about party per se. This is about these white people are concerned that they're losing their way of life, right? And Trump is the last thing standing between them and the rest of us, progressive, people of color, feminists, immigrants, period.
Okay. the one thing I can say as a liberal professors, conservative professors, it's hard. People like that the students come to classes like there's a blank slate. Trust me, they're not a blank slate. They already believe what they believe before they came to the classroom. And 16 weeks is not going to change it. So if you think that your student is being brainwashed, trust me, the university isn't the one that's doing it. You probably did a good job yourself of doing that. So and the research validates that too. Let's see. So someone had a question. Let's keep it light here. Kanye West is running for president. Do you think, and I don't even think Kanye is really connected with Black Lives Matter, but in terms of this election, could he siphon votes away from Biden? What do you guys think?
I wasn't in Professor Parker's camp. I didn't see Trump coming, so I think anything is possible. And I think part of how we got Trump is because of the sort of media fascination with him very early on that allowed him, you know, that propelled him in some of those early primaries. And so my sense is if we don't want Kanye West siphoning votes, we should really kind of ignore this and not give him too much of the sort of media attention that he's craving.
Oh, Professor Stevens Dugan, someone said that Kanye just ended his presidential run today.
Oh, I missed it.
That was short-lived.
Wow. Okay. Kanye West. All right. Let's move to something else. Oh, an interesting question, and I don't know if this was said in jest or not, but it said, Professor Parker, did you just say that old conservative is the same as an old racist?
No. What I did was I used them interchangeably. Right, and I meant like the reactionary kind, not a more like sort of Bob Dole, like, you know, no, they're not the same. Although some people would call people who are conservative on race racist, and well, you call me one. I call people who are racially conservative racist too. So if that's the question, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But if we're talking about more establishment conservatives, you know, who are just more about, you know, smaller government or limited government and personal responsibility, that's different, right? One is not necessarily a racist if one believes in those things. But if you are, one is racially conservative, yes, you're racist.
Okay. Professor Giardina, do you have, just kind of going back to your conversation about this idea of a white identity, I think this is going to have to be the last question, response.
Oh, you mean in response to the question about conservatives?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there was a difference between, you know, what we sometimes call Rockefeller Republicans and members of the sort of modern conservative party. But, you know, I would say, too, that the, you know, policies historically in the United States that promote smaller government, that promote a smaller welfare state, it's really hard to separate those from race in the United States. And one thing that I would argue, and I think that my research supports, is that that's one way in which white Americans maintain unequal power in the United States. It's one reason why whites have 80% of the wealth in the United States, and that Black Americans are unable to, you know, acquire much of it. We can go back to the period of time in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and even before then, when quote unquote old conservatives were, you know, in power, trying to, you know, prevent wealth redistribution and supporting things like redlining that have led to massive wealth inequality. And to say that that wasn't about race is really, I think, obscuring the reality of American history in the United States. And so, are they the same as today's overtly blatant racists? No, but were they also complicit in helping to maintain a system of racial inequality in the United States? Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're out of time. Wish we had longer, but I want to thank my guests for joining us, Professor LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, Professor Ashley Jardina, and Professor Christopher Parker, Michael Menta. Thank you. You guys have a great day, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.